It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll find out why some groups are calling for reform in horse racing on the eve of the Kentucky Derby.
First, we kick things off with Food Friday, and today we take a look at the traditional food movement and how we can work fresher and more locally produced foods into our lives.
Our next guest says the traditional food movement emphasizes nutrient-dense, real food, and values quality, environment, and community over the convenience of the processed food we find on grocery store shelves. So, how do we get started?
Joining us now is Jennifer McGruther. She's a food educator. Her new book is called The Nourished Kitchen, Farm-to-Table Recipes for the Traditional Foods Lifestyle. Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you've got this beautiful cookbook called The Nourished Kitchen, and you've also got a website by the same name that you launched in 2007. What were you trying to do with your take on traditional foods?
For me, it's an exploration of my own family's journey from processed foods into traditional foods and that culture, as well as a celebration of the foods that come from, you know, American farms.
And what counts as a traditional food or a traditional recipe?
When we think of traditional foods, we think of the foods that our great-great-grandmothers would have prepared. So they're foods in which processed ingredients are absent, processed ingredients such as refined white sugar, refined white flour, refined vegetable oils, those are absent. And instead, we emphasize nutrient-dense whole foods like grass-fed meats, animal fats like butter, as well as heirloom vegetables, whole grains, fresh fruits, those kinds of foods are traditional foods.
So you mentioned a journey of your family moving from processed foods to traditional foods. How did you make that transition?
For my husband and I, in 2007, began a farmer's market. I live in a community that is relatively isolated in the central mountains of Colorado. And so we didn't have access to a lot of fresh, high-quality fruits and vegetables. So we started a farmer's market in our area, and that's really where our journey to the traditional foods movement began.
You were motivated in part by Dr. Weston A. Price. Can you tell us about his work and why it inspired you?
Dr. Price was a dentist who operated in the early part of the 20th century, and in his practice, he began to see a strong shift in the health of his clients as they moved from, you know, the foods of their great-grandmothers to the more processed foods that contain refined vegetable oils, lots of sugar, caffeine, and processed flours. He found that the children were not as robust on this modernized diet, and he found that for many children were suffering from rampant dental decay. And so he left his practice, and he traveled the world seeking out very, very isolated populations that didn't have access to modern foods and therefore had to subsist on locally grown foods, or whatever they had available to them. And he found that those societies that adhered to traditional diets that in which modern foods were absent, exhibited exemplary health. They were free from tooth decay. They were free from a lot of our modern illnesses that many people suffer from. And overall, they exhibited just resilient health. By contrast, he would look at the same ethnic populations who did have access to modern foods. And again, within those populations who consumed a great deal of refined sugars, refined flours, refined oils, their health plummeted. And they suffer from dental decay as well as many other issues.
Wow. And did you see that same kind of benefit with your own family?
Certainly. My family is very healthy. We get sick less frequently than our peers. And our illnesses, you know, for example, the common cold, usually lasts only, you know, 1 to 2 days. So certainly our health has improved overall on a traditional food diet.
Well, I want to start getting into the food because most of the Nourished Kitchen is recipes. A lot of people associate healthy food with boring, flavorless food, self-sacrifice, or giving up lots of things that we might like. What philosophy goes into the recipes that you put into the Nourished Kitchen?
Well, first of all, I want us all to embrace our food with joy and reverence. We should take pleasure in what we eat. So in that respect, I kind of deviate from the classic health food movement, which is about restriction and self-denial, and instead focus on the wide variety of beautifully healthy, nutrient-dense foods that are available to us. So it's a book of balance. It's a book that emphasizes fermented foods and cooked foods and raw foods, grass-fed meats, healthy fats, and just generally unprocessed foods. So what I find is that if we return to the popular traditions of, 200, 300 years ago in terms of culinary perspective, we really find a lot of beautifully healthy foods that are actually remarkably flavorful as well.
One food that's kind of gone out of fashion is lard, and it's one that you're bringing back. Why lard?
Lard is perhaps one of the most reviled fats of our time, and I don't think it deserves its nasty reputation. Lard is very rich in monounsaturated fat. It's about 45% monounsaturated fat. That is the same heart-healthy fat that we find in olive oil and avocado, two foods that are lauded for their health benefits. Lard, when it is produced from pasture-raised pigs, not only is rich in that monounsaturated fat, but it is also a remarkably good source of vitamin D. Now, we must remember that a few years ago, there was a study done on children's populations and found that up to 70% of U.S. children were suffering from deficient or insufficient levels of vitamin D. And this comes not only from not being outside very frequently, but also from not consuming adequate amounts of vitamin D in our diet. And lard is a beautiful fat that is rich in monounsaturated fatty acids. It's rich in vitamin D, and also it has a great flavor and composition that it lends to culinary applications, both in pastries as well as for sauteing fruit, vegetables, and things like that.
Well, moving to kind of the opposite end of the spectrum, radishes coming up in season soon. I usually think of radishes as something I eat raw, just dipped in salt or on a salad. You have recipes, and I think you make the case for cooking radishes. What do we do to make warm radishes good?
One of my favorite recipes that's in the book is blistered radishes, in which they're sauteed in beautiful butter, grass-fed butter, and sprinkled with parsley and salt and pepper. And when they're cooked, we know radishes have that very sharp flavor. When they're cooked, that sharpness is subdued slightly, and radishes become wonderfully sweet. So that's a great recipe for this time of year.
We're talking right now with food educator and author Jennifer McGruther about the traditional foods lifestyle and farm-to-table eating. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferretz. Today on Food Friday, we are talking with Jennifer McGruther, author of The Nourished Kitchen. She's urging us to return to a traditional foods lifestyle, making foods where possible from seasonal goods, harvested as locally as we can, prepared at home. You can join with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Jennifer, we had a caller who couldn't stay on the line who said, hey, with all the seasonal stuff, what do you do during the winter?
That's a good question. During the wintertime, we have a lot of root vegetables and storage crops that can sustain us throughout the wintertime. For my family, we eat more meat during the wintertime. We eat a lot of butternut squash. We eat fresh potatoes. We eat beets and turnips, cabbage. And also, we eat a lot of fermented foods. There's an entire chapter in the Nourished Kitchen about fermented foods. Remember, fermentation, that is the making of sauerkraut and similar items, was a way that many people traditionally preserve the harvest so that it would last all winter long until grains arrived in spring again.
And now that it is spring again, what are some things that you're cooking, a recipe or two from your book that you're excited about?
Well, spring brings such wonderful, wonderful foods. One of my favorite dishes this time of year is the fresh herb frittata. And that is a frittata that is made with super fresh eggs, as well as all of the herbs that come into season this time of year, chervil, parsley, those kinds of ingredients. We often forget that eggs and milk and cream, they all have a season too, just like fresh vegetables.
Is that when the grasses are up and the animals who are grazing can get the freshest sort of food in their diet?
Exactly, exactly. So eggs and milk and all of these have seasons as well. And what we find is that some of the cream in springtime is just a wonderful, rich flavor, has a remarkable color. It's nice and yellow, and that's because the animals are grazing on fresh pasture. And also eggs tend to be at their peak between spring and summer due to the sunlight, which is increasing and then will later decrease.
when you're talking about eggs and meat and milk and cream, you're looking for stuff raised in a particular way, grass-fed where possible. A lot of times this is more expensive, not available in all areas of the country, or not easy to find anyway. Is this something everybody can do?
I think that it becomes accessible for everyone if we began to practice intention and mindfulness. Now, I always recommend a good, better, best approach to traditional food than to eating a whole diet. Do the best you can with what you have and always strive to do better.
Now, I want to ask you about another food that I am dying to come into season. I'm on strawberry vigil right now. I need there to be fresh strawberries. And you have an amazing sounding recipe in your book. It's called Strawberries in Minted Honey Syrup. Can you walk us through that one?
Absolutely. So it's a wonderful dish for springtime. And basically, you make a thin syrup out of water and honey, and you marinate fresh strawberries in this thin syrup along with some fresh mint. So what that does is that sweetens the strawberries very slightly. As we know, the first strawberries can be a little less sweet than the ones later on in the season. It infuses them with a wonderful bright flavor. And then, of course, you have the remaining syrup, which is flavored of strawberries, and you can use that to sweeten an iced tea or as a syrup over yogurt as well.
That sounds great. Well, and a lot of people are also thinking about gardening season now. What are a couple or two or three favorite things to grow in the garden to have ready through the summer and into the fall?
I think that radishes are, we spoke about radishes mm-hmm. a little bit earlier, but they're a wonderful thing to grow because they take such a little time to go from seed to being ready. So it's about 20 to 30 days. Lettuces are also wonderful this time of year, and they'll begin to bolt once the season gets hotter, once it gets hotter towards summer. And of course, everybody loves vine ripened tomatoes.
Yeah, definitely waiting for those too. And there's a traditional cake in here I want to ask you about. It's called Portugal cake. What is that? And what are the traditions behind that one?
Portugal cake is a fascinating recipe. It was an enormously popular cake during the 18th and 17th centuries, and it started to fall from popularity by the middle half of the 19th century. Portugal cake is a cake that is made with blanched almond flour. Now, blanched almond flour was a very, very popular way to make confections up until about 150 years ago to 200 years ago. And then that blanched almond flour is combined with unrefined cane sugar, butter, and eggs, and then it's sweetened, it's seasoned with sherry and rose water. So it's got a very unique flavor that it's absolutely lovely. And it's dotted with dried currants. So it's got an old world simplicity to it. It's very, very rich, and it's a beautiful cake.
And does it have a decent amount of protein because of the almond flour?
It's a fat and protein rich cake. So unlike the cakes that we're accustomed to now that are made with white flour that tend to be very, very light and very rich in carbohydrate, most of the cakes that were prepared, certainly in the United States and in colonial America, were prepared with an emphasis on almond flour. Almonds are rich in fat and they're rich in protein, and that helps to balance the sugar within the cake.
And almond flour, I haven't been in the market for it. Is that pretty readily available in stores?
You should be able to find it in any well-stocked grocery store.
Excellent. And as far as looking forward to the later phases of the growing season, right now we're in sort of these beginning tendrils of spring, but what are you looking forward to down the road, late summer, early fall?
Late summer is lovely. We get a lot of fennel in my area in late summer, and one of the ways I like to prepare it is through fermentation. Fennel is wonderful when it's combined with cabbage, another late season crop, or with kohlrabi, that kind of Martian-looking vegetable that you can sometimes find at farmers' markets. And you can ferment that with green apples and produce a really remarkable relish. Fennel has that wonderful licorice-like flavor. As summer waxes into autumn, you'll find a lot of potatoes coming up, turnips, which are much reviled, but unfortunately so. You also find winter radishes, cabbages, and beets, too.
Jennifer, a wonderful vision of things to come to end with there. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
That was Jennifer McRuthers. She's the author of The Nourished Kitchen, Farm-to-Table Recipes for the Traditional Foods Lifestyle. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
Fans of horse racing and fancy hats are eagerly anticipating tomorrow's running of the 140th Kentucky Derby. While the race will certainly generate a lot of competition and pomp and circumstance, a scandal is drawing some attention from the main event.
An undercover video released earlier this year by PETA appeared to show one of racing's most successful trainers forcing lame and over-medicated horses to run. It's the latest incident that's got various groups calling for reform in horse racing.
Joining us now to talk about the PETA investigation and calls for reform in horse racing is Pia Catton. She's a reporter at the Wall Street Journal, where she covers the arts, culture, and horse racing. Pia, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
Well, let's start with Steve Asmussen, the trainer at the center of this story. Who is he and why is he so under the microscope this weekend at the Derby?
Steve Asmussen is one of the winningest trainers in the sport right now in North America. And he was the target of a undercover video sting by people for the ethical treatment of animals. So they had someone go undercover and record one of his assistants talking in callous terms, I think you could say fairly, about the horses. And the way that the video is edited, it appears to show the horses being over-medicated. It appears to show the staff talking about jockeys using buzzers when they're on the horses to make them run faster in a race. So it showed a lot of very negative things about the industry, and it has sparked a lot of calls for reform of the industry.
And has Asmussen, or I imagine at this point maybe his lawyers, have we heard a response to these allegations from PETA?
Yes. Well, I ran into the trainer earlier this week, and he said, you know, this is really not the time and place to talk about it. Okay. His lawyer has said there's actually no accusation of wrongdoing in the reports that PETA has filed, because what PETA has done is asked New York and Kentucky for investigations into Asmussen's barn. So that's on the legal side of things. That's how they've responded.
And you're on the scene there. Is this really the buzz at the Derby this year?
Well, you know, the thing about racing is that there are very difficult moments in the sport all the time. And we are all here because we love animals and we love the races and we love horses. So there's a duality to all of this. There's some kind of... you know, we're all drawn to it because we want to see these races, but we know on a certain level there's something else going on, and it's a very difficult dichotomy to deal with, I have to say. I mean, from my own personal perspective, people aren't talking about it all that much, but, you know, when you do raise it, everybody kind of shakes their head and really wishes this sort of thing weren't true and we didn't have to face this, but as fans of this sport, we do.
And going back, this isn't the first time, as you say, that these issues have come up. Are there people within horse racing who want to see changes and make sure these kind of things don't happen?
Yes, there are quite a few people who want to see change happen and who have been very vocal about it. And there are a number of changes that could happen pretty easily. Number one, releasing the veterinary records in the 14 days prior to a race. So you would know how much a horse has been medicated or how much he... maybe has a foot problem or a hoof problem. So those things would be available, not necessarily to bettors. We're not really sure how this would work, but it would be available to the community so people could know if a horse is being treated to mask pain. And that's one of the key issues here. You know, when people think about racing, sometimes if they're not really familiar with it, you think, oh, well, is it, you know, what, Lance Armstrong, that type of thing? Is it, mm-hmm. is it that kind of situation? And it's not quite that, and it's also not necessarily just shooting up a horse with steroids like baseball players might. It's a little more subtle in that what people are accusing some trainers of doing is using legal medication to mask pain so that horses can run even if they are lame or sore or if they have a flaw. They can still get on the track.
And this would theoretically be bad for the horse in the long run once those medications wear off.
Exactly, because, you know, you think about it yourself. If you are a runner and you say, wow, my ankle's really hurting, but I'm just going to take a lot of Advil or a painkiller, then you get out there because you're not hurting. But you may injure yourself further by going out there for a run. And that's exactly what happens very often. Well, I shouldn't say very often. It does happen. That's why we see a lot of horse breakdowns on the track. An ankle or a foot will break down, and then a horse has to be carted off. So that's one type of one pillar of the reform is focusing on limiting the number of legal medications that trainers can use and making sure that there are no race day medications. Currently, there are a few race day medications, and some in the industry would like to eliminate all race day medications.
Well, thinking about where this kind of reform might come from, another sports scandal this week was in the NBA. News broke this weekend. By midweek, the guy in charge of the NBA had announced punishment and called for more. Is there anything like that in the horse racing world where it's that guy or that body who we look to for reform?
The easy answer to that is no. Every state has its own commissions and its own rules to govern penalties. They have their own rules to govern medication. So they also have their own laboratories and their own credentials for the laboratories. And there is an effort afoot to standardize those from state to state. That may happen. It may take some time. It may be the kind of process that takes place the way that the U.S. Anti-Doping Association has moved forward. So as with the Olympics, every country had to bring its standard up to a world anti-doping organization standard. So we could see that same type of thing happen among the states in the U.S. in regard to racing. But currently there is no commissioner. There is no single regulatory body the way you have an NBA or you have the NFL.
So it could be something like the state of Kentucky does something or whoever's in charge of the Derby does something, but there are all these other races, famous and less so, that might not be touched by that.
Well, it really would have to boil down to each state adopting one set of reform. And if every state could agree to the same set of rules, and that effort is out there, then trainers could go from one state to the next and know that the rules are the same. And what that is specifically referring to is that in certain states, you can race your horse with certain medications on race day. In certain states, you cannot. So it's confusing on some level for the trainers.
Now, within the horse racing world itself, if I think of one sport that is steeped in tradition, I think racing would be near the top of my list. Is that another factor that might slow down reform efforts?
Tradition is indeed a slow thing to change. I mean, this sport really does have very deep traditions. Look, this Kentucky Derby is the 140th. Saratoga last year celebrated its 150th season. So, yeah, indeed, it's not a new sport that can just say, all right, let's change some rules very quickly. That culture, though, I think needs a little bit of a jolt because things cannot just simply go on as they have, really. I mean, I think that the groundswell of opinion and the outside forces of people saying, look, something has to be done here. And I think in the age of media and social media, I think a lot of people are making that voice heard.
I gather there's an organization of jockeys that does transcend those state boundaries at least. What has their organization said or thought about reform efforts, and do they have any sway, any power to make reforms happen?
I think you might be referring to the Jockey Club. And in the case of the Jockey Club, the name is a bit of a misnomer because it's actually a group that focuses on it is the registry of the breed. Mm. So if a horse's DNA is not technically a thoroughbred, that is the organization that looks at the DNA and says, okay, no, that's not part of the breed, and this is part of the breed. And that organization also rejects or accepts names for horses. The jockeys themselves don't have a lot of power in this sport. I mean, it's an interesting role for the jockeys, really, because they're the ones who are very close to the horse, and they are the humans who have the most risk. But it's a really tough job, and unfortunately, they really don't have much say in the process.
Have we seen successful reform efforts in the past?
That is an interesting question. Yes, you could say that there is reform in certain states, and that certain states are more willing to move forward to a national uniform rule standard. There are also tracks that have tried different things. They have tried different surfaces, like a synthetic surface replacing dirt. Also, certain tracks race on grass. But, you know, as you said, as you pointed out, tradition is hard to come by. And, you know, even though the rest of the world does not use race day medications, it's having a very difficult time. The idea that we in the U.S. should be racing without race day medication has been a very difficult point to find agreement on.
Pia, I want to wrap up by getting back to the Derby. You mentioned the dichotomy between these serious and difficult issues and the joy of horse racing and the love of the horses. Apart from this whole situation, what should we be watching for at the race this weekend?
Right. I mean, this day is just so fun. The Kentucky Derby is one of those days when you just see America at a colorful and happy and kind of joyful moment. At the Derby, California Chrome is the favorite. And that horse has got a very good shot, really, but we don't really know who he's been running against. He's been winning quite a lot and been winning with dramatic victories, but we're not really sure who his competitors have really been. And that's part of the fun of the Derby. These are very young horses, and you're never really sure what their past races mean. In addition, there's a horse named Danza, named for Tony Danza, the actor, and another horse by the name of Wicked Strong that's a possible contender, and a lot of people are interested in that horse. And it is named in honor of the victims of the Boston Marathon bombing.
Pia, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Pia Catton covers horse racing for The Wall Street Journal.